Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm again joined by Alexandra Philandra, a political scientist at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Welcome back to the show, Alexandra.
Hey, Trey. Nice to talk to you again. I don't know. We can have a rational debate. I don't know if the topics are rational, though.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the nature of being a political scientist, right? We have to rationally study the irrational. I mean, we're talking about humans, right?
That is absolutely true. And sometimes, you know, you have to look twice and say, am I sleeping or not? Is this a dream?
No, it is not a dream. We are not in the cave, as far as I know.
I don't know.
Just a little Plato humor here on Black Friday as we're recording this. So I hope, listeners, that you all had an amazing Thanksgiving. And I hope that you either were the good capitalists that you are and you went shopping today and helped corporations, or maybe you're a capitalist like me, but you still stayed home because you just hate it anyway. but we hope that you had a really great Thanksgiving. But we are here to review this week, and we've had a fascinating week, right? So maybe we're in the cave after all. We're going to figure it out, because the thing that was, I think, really crazy this week was we had the federal court in San Francisco temporarily blocking the Trump administration's new asylum ban, saying that it violates existing law and would cause irreparable harm to immigrants. Then, of course, Donald Trump jumps on Twitter and says effectively that this temporary restraint against his move is horrendous. In fact, he is going to argue that the Ninth Circuit is just a bunch of Obama judges, quote unquote, and will be responsible for, quote, bedlam, chaos, injury, and death, end quote, for not letting law enforcement do their jobs. Now, you would think that, okay, that's just another week in the Trump administration. But this week, the Chief Justice of the United States decided it was time to respond. And so Chief Justice Roberts took the unusual step of defending the court in public and specifically argued there are no Obama or Bush judges or any other judges. There's just judges. Trump would then hit back again and say, quote, Roberts can say what he wants, but, quote, the Ninth Circuit is a complete and total disaster, out of control, with a horrible reputation. And so the two of them have been going back and forth now. And as a matter of fact, I think in a lot of the news, the set off here, the asylum ban, was kind of been lost. So let's dive into the cave. And Alexandra, what do you think about all this?
The decision in itself is consistent with prior decisions of the court so far, so it was not a real surprise. The courts have said that given how these executive actions are written by the Trump administration, they're not consistent with congressional laws, and as a result, they're not valid. So a lot of them.
I mean, specifically, the district court judge Tiger is going to say, look, quote, whatever the scope of the president's authority, he may not rewrite the immigration laws to impose a condition that Congress has expressly forbidden. In other words, he can't just make it up as he go along. It has to be part of what Congress has done. And I know this is actually your area, so if you want to weigh, I would love to hear what you think about that.
Yeah, basically, as much as there is a lot of leeway for the executive branch to make decisions about individual immigrants and in terms of adjudication procedures, there isn't a lot of very strict oversight. It's still the case that whatever regulations the executive branch institutes when it comes to issues of either admissions of immigrants or asylum seekers, which is actually governed not just by U.S. law, but also by treaties that the U.S. has signed on and pledged to respect since the 1940s. So especially when it comes to asylum, the rules are quite strict about what you're supposed to do and how to do it. And the executive branch can't just make it up. as they go, and they can't just have, for example, asylum seekers basically camp out in Mexico while the U.S. is doing nothing. There is a specific procedure that has to be followed.
I mean, specifically, the plaintiff's complaint was that they were violating the Immigration and Nationality Act, which listeners, basically says that even if you've crossed the border illegally, if you make it onto U.S. soil, you're still eligible to apply for asylum. And specifically, what the Trump administration was suggesting, what they were banning was that, in fact, that you had to be at certain locations to make that possible, and that is what was getting struck down from U.S. District Judge Tiger.
Correct. Yes, exactly. So basically, if you are an asylum seeker, even if you arrive in the country without permission, you should still be allowed to make your asylum claim. And while this asylum case is adjudicated, you're allowed to stay in the United States. And precedent is that you also stay free, and you even get temporary working papers while these cases are adjudicated.
Which is different from those who are crossing for other reasons.
Correct. Absolutely. People who are crossing just to work are not eligible for the same protections, and they can be sent back, basically deported right away.
Well, they can also be detained during the duration of their proceedings, correct?
Correct. And this is the other change that the Trump administration wants to impose, which is to detain asylum seekers as well for the duration of the adjudication process, which is not consistent with current legislation, but also it can be really costly, both in terms of human suffering and in terms of actual material cost.
What do you mean by that, material?
If you have to detain an extra 50,000 people and keep them for 3 years, because that's how long it can take.
Oh, you mean the cost to the country, effectively?
Absolutely.
I understand. When you were saying material cost, I was a little lost about that. Okay. I hear you now. Yeah.
The financial cost of detaining people who are coming in as asylum seekers, who generally are people who have already suffered quite a bit, because the bar for actually receiving asylum is really, really high, and it's very, very difficult. The specific requirements that you have to meet are not simple or easy. So for these people, to keep them in detention for several years that could take to adjudicate their cases, because these have to go through actual immigration court hearings. These are not cases that can be administratively disposed of the way that simple deportation cases. They have to go through the process.
Now, what do you think, though, about, I mean, that's very interesting of itself, but what do you think about this now back and forth between the president and the Chief Justice of the United States, especially considering that Justice Roberts is a Bush appointee? In some ways, you would assume that these two gentlemen would be on the same broad page. But the fact that Justice Roberts went out of his way to do something very unusual, right? The court generally stays out of the fray. And in this case, Roberts is very explicitly calling out the President of the United States. What do you think about this aftermath to the decision itself, Alexandra?
It is definitely something that hasn't happened in about 200 years. The last time that a sitting president judged had criticism against a Supreme Court justice was Thomas Jefferson, who was not happy about John Marshall's approach to the Supreme Court constitutional adjudication. But since then, there has been a very, very strong norm that has been followed by every other president of deference to the Supreme Court and not criticizing the court or individual justices.
What do you think about Jackson? As a matter of fact, I was thinking about Jackson with Native Americans and his, and in fact, completely ignoring the Supreme Court and outright saying, well, you know, make the ruling you want to make. You know, you've made your decision, now enforce it. What do you think about the connections there? I mean, I agree with you on Jefferson, but what about Jackson?
Yes, I think that there is also an echo of that. And I know that Trump has expressed an interest and sort of an admiration for Andrew Jackson. I'm not sure how much he actually knows about Andrew Jackson.
But there are commonalities there. I agree with you.
Yes. But we definitely see a president, and I don't know to what extent this goes beyond Trump, is the other thing. There is a president who basically understands his role as the equivalent of the, you know, the French le loi c'est moi, the law is me, and if anyone contradicts what he says in small or big ways, because there are from fights with the Supreme Court to fights with the NBA players, he's willing to take them all on and criticize them, even the most trivial criticisms he's willing to engage in, because he's just not willing to basically ignore anyone who is rebuking him at any level.
One of the things that kind of stood out to me is that I find Trump's Twitter rants and his confrontational style and his method of governing, I think I've covered it all there, kind of appalling. And I think listeners, you know, if you've listened to the show, you know this. But I occasionally find myself having begrudging agreement with Trump. And it's fascinating because I've thought about this week a significant amount where, you know, Trump, he basically says in response to Chief Justice Roberts, yeah, there really are Obama and Bush judges. And I wonder, do you think that Roberts, in saying that there aren't, is just attempting to uphold, I mean, much of the court's power rests on this kind of fictional idea of their placement within the society. In other words, that we hold them in that position. And so him defending the court is defending, in fact, its legitimacy and its power source. But while Trump probably shouldn't be pointing it out, do you think he's right that effectively we really do have Obama or Bush judges? And if we didn't, why would we have so much confrontation over the contemporary appointment process? So is what Trump's saying wrong, or is it just the wrong way to approach it? And is what Justice Roberts is saying is wrong, but maybe a better way of hiding it?
Yes. Basically, there are judges who come in with specific judicial philosophies, which may be either more consistent with the left or the right. I wouldn't necessarily call them Clinton and Obama and Bush specifically, because to me, that actually personalizes it and it says something about a personal loyalty rather than a judicial philosophy. So definitely I agree if we're talking about, you know, do we have judges who have a more left-wing versus a right-wing philosophical approach to the law and they see the law in different ways? We definitely do have that. And that is the Senate and the whatever administration of the time looking for people who are more philosophically akin to the administration's position? Yes, but there is, I think, a somewhat there's an important distinction that needs to be made here in the context of Trump, because it this is not about, from my perspective, the way I understand Trump, this is not about a judicial philosophy issue. He's not saying that this justice or this other judge is left more left-wing or more right-wing. This is about defying him personally and not showing loyalty to him, because he expects from everyone in government to follow his lead and do what he says. So from his perspective, an Obama judge and a Bush judge are exactly that they're people who are loyal to the presidents who appointed them. And from that, go ahead.
No, I mean, that's very interesting. I had not thought about it from that. He's putting in that in a very personalized context. And I think maybe many of us who are closer to this, I'll include myself, I think you're right. I was reading that as an ideological position, but that's probably a really bad reading of Trump, given that he clearly doesn't have deep ideological positions in that sense. When you look at him, you know, foreign policy to domestic, it is significantly different. And so he's assuming it's all personal, not potentially ideological.
And that's, from my perspective, that's the meaning of that. And also in the context of the Kavanaugh hearings, which also basically the selection of Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court seemed to be not, from Trump's perspective, who had choices among a variety of conservatives, what Kavanaugh fulfilled for him seems like his very peculiar set of beliefs and attitudes about executive power and the role of the president in the context of a situation like the one that we are in, that there is the possibility of impeachment.
Well, and that, so, I think, brings us nicely to our next topic, which is going to be the Dem majority that is now coming into Congress shortly. Data here that I think we're going to need to spend some time in talking about, and we had a big letter just come out today that I think is a side story to this. Nationally, Democrats took 53.1% of all votes counted in the midterms, while Republicans took 45.2%, now that we're done with all of our recounting. And that means that not since the Watergate scandal have Democrats had such a large margin of victory in a midterm House race. And a lot of that, I think, is clearly tied to the fact that we had one of our highest turnouts in modern midterm history, tallying in, as a matter of fact, at the second highest that we've ever had. And so right now, that means that Democrats have a lead of Republicans in the House popular vote by about 8.6 million votes. So we have a Democratic majority House that is now going to be the foil for Trump. But we also have this question of, well, what does this mean in the larger context for Republicans and Democrats in 2020? So, Alexandra, I know that's a lot to take on in one question. So take ever whatever part of that you'd like and tell us what you think.
So my first prediction is that if the 2010 Congress was the do nothing Congress, this is going to be the absolutely do nothing Congress.
Well, some of us are happy about that. Me. So do you think, though, even if it doesn't get anything done, do you think this is going to end up being the photo op Congress? I mean, this is an opportunity for Democrats to potentially either make it or break it, in my opinion. Are they going to go after Trump? In what ways do they go after Trump? Or does this offer Trump a second chance at narrative lead? Because he seems to do much better when he's fighting something rather than when he's getting along with something.
Absolutely. That is absolutely the case, because even with a Republican legislature, he couldn't actually get them to work with him on his main initiatives. He just couldn't really play the role of the executive, the bully pulpit, the person who actually leads. So to have an opposition party in the House is going to be great political theater for him, because he now has a lot more freedom to basically say it's not my fault, it's the Democrats' fault. He even offered to have the Republicans vote for Nancy Pelosi for exactly that reason, because he knows that there is so much antipathy towards Pelosi among his base, that, you know, it's like, let's have her in so that I have an easy target that everybody that who voted for me is going to really focus on and really make them rile up. So he's good at this. He's really good at this.
And it makes a side conversation among the Democratic Party have to come into the foreground, because up to this point, there's been this question: what's the right way to combat Donald Trump? Do we go after him the way he goes after people? Do we, you know, engage in tweet wars with him? What's the way to make this happen? And to this point, it has been more or less an academic question. I don't mean that as an insult to us, but there's been no pragmatic teeth to it. But now that you have a majority in the House, there's the possibility to have some teeth to this question. And I don't know if the Democrats have an answer. If you were the one who was advising them, what would you suggest, Alexandra?
I think that it's a really difficult decision, because, I mean, they can't focus really on policy anyway, because they can't get it through the Senate. The Democratic base does want clarity and does want investigations on a lot of the scandals and everything that has to do with Trump and his family. So I expect that there is going to be an investigation fest no matter what in Congress, because people are expecting it. And a lot of the Democrats, both in the elites and the base, are ready to draw blood. And Trump knows this. It's going to be a lot of excitement as of January, for sure.
Well, and on that note, I mean, one of the things the Democrats have to figure out is Nancy Pelosi. Earlier this week, we had 16 Democrats sign a letter releasing it and arguing that they are in opposition to Nancy Pelosi being the Speaker of the House again, and very much narrowing her path to winning. Now, for listeners, as you think about this math, keep in mind that in the House, that the Speaker is elected from the entire House. So that means that to win, you actually need more than simply a majority, in most cases, of your own party, because that wouldn't be enough to overcome the opposition of the opposition's party. So the numbers here are very difficult when the House is narrowly split, which it is in this case, comparatively. And today we had some really big news, as we had an additional 9 members who signed a letter arguing that they were not going to vote for Nancy Pelosi unless they were agreeing to their, quote, break the gridlock rule changes. In other words, they want some changes to the way things are done procedurally in the House. And some of these things are issues that I do not think that Pelosi will be willing to give on all the way. Now, she's already been on the ground trying to get support. Representative Fudge from Ohio, who had posed Pelosi, has now withdrawn that after she was offered the position of chairwoman of the House Administration Subcommittee on Elections. So, but all of this kind of nitty-gritty aside, Alexandra, what do you think Nancy Pelosi, our listeners have some really really strong opinions on this subject, especially from the left. And I know that Ken, he is a supporter. Ken Katkin is a supporter of Nancy Pelosi, and he took some flack for that a couple of weeks ago. Alexandra, what do you think about this? Is Pelosi the right way forward? Is she not the right way forward? And as a matter of pragmatics, no one is yet running against her.
It is a very curious situation for me within the Democratic Party, because Pelosi is one of the most effective House leaders that the Democrats have ever had. She has been really instrumental in getting the Obama agenda through and getting Obamacare through the House. She is an incredible vote counter and being able to whip the party together and get things done. And she has been also unbelievably good at fundraising. So it is still curious to me as to why is there so much grumbling and opposition to Nancy Pelosi, given her successful record. And I understand it coming from the right.
Yeah, we can even just put that aside for a minute, you know, just talk about the left. I mean, I can say from the point of view of our listeners and what I've been reading is many of them basically say, one, she's not far enough to the left. She's not part of the new mainstream left movement. And as a matter of fact, that her, as you're kind of putting it in a positive light, her ability to count these votes is really her ability to come to the center and to sell out the true Democratic Party. And it's time to stop having the Nancy Pelosi's bean counters in the world. And it's time to start having some true leftists. Now, again, I'm not ascribing to that view necessarily. I'm just suggesting that that seems to be, though, what both listeners and others don't like.
It's interesting, though, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who represents the new left and, you know, the new blood in the House, actually is supporting Pelosi. She came out and said, no, I'm going to support Nancy Pelosi, because right now she's an experienced leader. And she has a plan forward, and nobody else of all these people who are grumbling about this, nobody has come up with a vision and a concrete leadership plan. And it's not the same thing to complain as to have a plan.
No, that's very true. And it's a difficult position for Democrats, because it very well could be this case in a number of seats that a vote for Nancy Pelosi will end up losing someone an election in 2020.
It could be, depending on this is going to be such a very intense and interesting 2 years that it is very hard right now to predict what's happening in 2020, given all the investigations that's going to take place. Like, there's so many moving parts right now on the board that, based on today's very narrow view of the world and how successful the right has been in focusing on Pelosi, but the right within the next 18 months may have so many more things in its hands to deal with that Nancy Pelosi may be low on their radar screen. So it's a lot. It is very, very difficult to predict right now, given how consequential the next 2 years can be politically and partisan terms.
It is. And, you know, and that's one of the really tough things, I think, when you're trying to educate people about the political system. And that is what seems really, really important in this moment in time may not be the most important variable. As a matter of fact, in my classes this week, past couple of weeks, we were covering media and politics. And it's funny because we take a little quiz and we try to see what issues they actually remember, you know, a month ago, 2 months ago, 6 months ago, a year ago. You know, very few things make it that long term. And so I think you're right when you're trying to make those kinds of predictions. It's difficult. But I think in the case of Nancy Pelosi, at least, I don't think she's going to be one, and I don't think these votes are going to be one that will exit the radar of either the Republicans or the Democrats. I think this is going to be a defining moment in my position. And I agree with you. She has been successful along a number of metrics. And I come from the opposite end of the spectrum. But if you want to get things passed, I understand you put her in charge. But I wonder if putting her back in charge doesn't just make Trump's life easier. And if you don't, I can... You know, if you want me to be the creator for the ads, I can make those ads in my sleep against Nancy Pelosi. And I just wonder if that isn't a short-term game for a long-term loss.
I don't know, because on the other hand, you have Chuck Schumer, who is equally, if not more, centrist, and has not been nowhere near as successful as Nancy Pelosi has been in the House. So when you look at the way these two are differentially treated, and also if you bring in the shadow of Hillary Clinton, I have to ask, is this about gender? And that is a big problem given what we know in the literature about how women are evaluated more harshly and differently than men. They're perceived to be weaker. They draw opposition a lot more than men do. So it's really difficult for me from the vantage point of November 2018 to tell if this is a level of sexism within the Democratic Party, which is alive and well.
Right. You know, that's actually a phenomenal point. And I think this is one of those times where you have kind of uncomfortable truths emerge. And as political scientists, we recognize that you have gender bias. It's straightforward. It's obvious to measure. But then you have the pragmatic political side, which is, well, do I attempt to overcome that bias potentially, right? Or do I say, well, wait a second, it's time to just win? And that's tough. That's a very tough question. And I think that's what, in part, it's not the whole part of it. That's part of what the Democratic Party is wrestling with, given that this is part of their identity.
Yes, absolutely. It's really difficult. I think that what it will come to is that because she's incredibly shrewd, she will figure out how to count her numbers in a way that she doesn't hurt people who might be vulnerable to the Nancy Pelosi ads. I think that I can't imagine that she will not have the votes.
Well, given that nobody's willing to run against her, I think that if somebody's willing to run against her, you would suggest that there are more votes not there. I agree with you. I think maybe the only thing we disagree on is I don't think it's quite up in the air how much this hurts in 2020. You know, if I was once again working on campaigns, I'd be talking like Donald Trump and happily seeing Nancy Pelosi take the gavel.
I don't totally disagree with you. I'm just saying that the 2020 map could be so much more complicated than that, that the Republicans may have to play defense in such ways, given how much they have compromised their brand, that would be the least of their of what they need to do in order to be successful.
And it's true. It also depends on if, you know, turnout remains high or not. And so I think it's time we're going to change to our next topic, which was we've already talked on the show a lot about the crime and the death of Jamal Khashoggi. But what we have not had a chance to talk about, and this is new to this week, has been the statement from President Donald Trump on our standing with Saudi Arabia, which is just a fascinating document. And listeners, I highly recommend that you go and read this, because I would love to just read the whole thing to you, but that's too much for the air. But it's very interesting. It's concise. And it's laden with exclamation points. I mean, it really feels like it came from the pen of Donald Trump, and you're either going to love that or you're going to hate that. But the short version of this is that Donald Trump is arguing that while the crime against Khashoggi is, quote, a terrible one, and one that our country does not condone, unquote, that we are not going to move away from Saudi Arabia. As a matter of fact, as Trump says, quote, maybe he did and maybe he didn't, quote, end quote, referring to the Crown Prince and his knowledge of this tragic event. Now, what's fascinating about this is that the CIA has already had a lot of evidence to suggest that he is the one who ordered it. As a matter of fact, we potentially have some audio recordings of him saying to take care of this issue. But Donald Trump is effectively saying that our security, our American first policy, and our need for oil means that, look, we got to blink at things like this. And he just says it in a loud way, again, that I think his supporters will like, and that those of us who like the English language won't like. So, Alexandra, what do you think about both the statement and the position of the United States on this? Because he's getting a lot of pushback, even within the Republican Party, on this topic.
And as he should, because there is another important detail to mention here. Khashoggi was an American legal permanent resident with an American family and American-born children.
Mm-hmm.
This is not somebody who has no ties to the United States. And in effect, what this type of rationalization and defense of Saudi Arabia means is that American journalists and critics, American critics of other regimes, can find themselves in mortal danger because the door has been opened. Other regimes, authoritarian regimes, who do not like what somebody on CNN or somebody on MSNBC or any other journalistic outlet can abduct them and kill them and that go unpunished?
Well, and I'll tell you what is particularly fascinating to me on this one is Trump, I think, in some ways, is doing the same thing that presidents from both parties have done from a long time, and that's look the other direction when it comes to the behavior of Saudi Arabia. What's fascinating here, and in some, I saw parallels between this and his conversation with Chief Justice Roberts, is effectively he is saying out loud, in a poor way, I think the policy of all of our contemporary presidents. But I think that maybe saying it this way, I hope, has put people in the position to think about it a little differently and say, well, why are we supporting Saudi Arabia in such a close relationship, given that, you know, they tear people apart in their own embassy?
Absolutely. And the thing is, but there are differences with previous administrations in the sense that they were more nuanced in the way that they approached alliances with uncomfortable alliances, whether it was Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Turkey or whoever, a variety of non-democratic regimes. There was a recognition that human rights and women's rights are important. They tried to sort of keep it both ways and do reaffirm norms that are important to the United States and, yes, keep the criticism at a manageable level so that they wouldn't enrage and create problems with these alliances, but at the same time, not come out and say, we don't care who you kill, we want the oil, which is essentially what's going on here. I mean, this is
well, it's, and it's even more than just the oil, and that's what threw me for a loop as I've read this statement was the argument here is that the only way to be America first and safe is to let Saudi Arabia kill people. I mean, how do you get from, you know, I mean, the last line of the statement is, you know, why are we going to do it this way? Very simply, it's called America first. And you were earlier talking about being in the cave. This is the closest to being in the cave that I felt this week, which was somehow being America first policy means if you're an American citizen, you get killed, murdered, not killed, murdered. Well, you know, oh well.
Because being what it means to put America first, it means to basically, in very strict financial terms, get benefits out of our relationship, get, you know, better trade deals, sell our products at a higher price. And whether this also is comes with a cost in terms of, yeah, a few Americans are killed and dismembered in, you know, in somebody's embassy, or, you know, they're fed polonium or something like that. It's a small price to pay because we get about $450 billion in contracts. So that's who America is. America under Trump is the America who cares about money and about being rich at the cost of all else. There is no price for being rich.
Yeah, this one is a particularly tough one for me. I had no doubt that the president was not going to take a hardline stance against Saudi Arabia, but I would never, a couple of weeks ago, I would never have predicted this particular statement. But given what we know what's going on inside the White House, maybe that shouldn't be quite as surprising. There's obviously a lot of shakeup going on. And that actually leads us to our last story for this week, which is the Whitaker appointment. So Sessions is out. We've already had Jay and Mike talking about that. But what we haven't had a chance to talk about is the appointment. And there's been a lot of arguments about Whitaker and effectively whether or not he can constitutionally hold this office. And so I want to talk about that just a second and then turn it over to you, Alexandra, for some analysis. What has been argued is that the president has appointed him unilaterally, meaning that he has not reached out to the Senate for a confirmation. Now, there is an argument that says that, look, the Federal Vacancies and Reform Act of 1998 allows the president to appoint someone for 210 days. If the person has worked in that role for 90 days and has received a GS-15 pay scale anywhere from a little over 100 to 130,000, and on that basis, Whitaker meets those requirements, so he doesn't have to have senatorial approval. However, those against him are arguing that actually that particular law is unconstitutional because they point to the appointments clause in the Constitution, which, as my students will be telling you on their final, is Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2, that says that the Senate must, quote, advise and consent, end quote, on naming any principal officer, even on temporary basis. So Whitaker is not Senate confirmed, and therefore he cannot be accurate. So what do you think about Whitaker in general? And what do you think about these arguments about his legitimacy?
Well, that takes us back actually in an interesting way to our initial conversation about John Roberts and about whether there are Trump judges and Obama judges and loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't supposed to be a Trump DOJ attorney general. The way that, especially after Watergate, the norms and rules and regulations of the Department of Justice and the role of the Attorney General has been to specifically be an independent agent in the service of the United States of America, of the people, and not a party loyalist or a presidential loyalist. He's not supposed to be, the Attorney General is not supposed to be somebody who is the president's Attorney General. Yet Trump has been consistently for 2 years talking about my Attorney General and whether this person or that person is a my Attorney General. So again, he's seeing the Department of Justice and as his lawyers and the Attorney General as basically his personal defense attorney, who is there to do his bidding and protect him from any harm that could come to him or his family. And that is incredibly problematic for a democratic society. That is a major no-no if we want to maintain democratic institutions. And unfortunately, Whitaker seems to signal that he is exactly that kind of the president's man. There is suggestion in the press that he has been informing through back channels the Trump administration about strategy related to Mueller and what's happening, keeping them in the loop about an investigation that directly involves the president and his entire family. And there's very, very good reason, given the public statement of Matt Whitaker on CNN, to expect that he's going to interfere with this investigation. He is conflicted out big time just on his statements alone. But even if you disregard the statements, there is an FBI investigation into Matt Whitaker and his previous employment with a patent company. So there's an extra layer of problems having Matt Whitaker, who's under FBI investigation, overseeing the FBI as acting attorney general. So these are just two levels of problems here.
Well, and it's interesting because this only actually pushes the can down the road a little bit, because come 210 days, well, less than 210 days from now, I'm forgetting which day he takes the appointment from Trump. So, you know, 205 or whatever it is now, he has to get Senate approval. And if you're going to do it, you'd think you'd want to do it sooner rather than later, because the closer you get to 2020, the more likely this is to be an issue as you move forward. So that's a fascinating bit of just pragmatic politics to me. But I agree with you. You know, Whitaker is a fascinating, and again, it does tie into that argument you had earlier that Trump is thinking in terms of the personal, not the ideological, and it's coming out again. But listeners, for now, we're going to have to say goodbye. Alexandra, it has been wonderful talking with you again this week.
It was great to talk to you, Trey. These are interesting topics. I wish our lives were not as interesting.
Well, isn't there the old Chinese proverb that your life may not be interesting? I think it's to that effect. So somebody cursed us, I guess. Maybe we'd be living in interesting times.
Yes, we are living in times that are way too interesting to bear. You know, like, literally, who knew that every single week there would be completely different new set of very weird, crazy, interesting stories happening? This is just not what we're used to as political scientists or as citizens, actually.
Yeah, which is why I think if you're listening and you don't subscribe to the show, you really do. You need to head over and subscribe to the show. And you can do that by heading to thepoliticsguys.com/subscribe, or you can head to politicsguys.com/support, or you can head to politicsguys.com and click on support. This show is possible because we have some just phenomenal Patreon and PayPal supporters. And I know that Mike has some great news coming up. If you subscribe, we now have even some additional bonus content you're going to be getting. You're going to be getting some bonus content from Mike, which is actually his take on American government. And you're going to be getting some bonus content from myself, which is the beginning of a podcast series only for supporters who support at a $5 level, I believe it is, for my American government set. You can get them together as a bonus package. So I highly recommend that you head to politicsguys.com and check that all out, because Alexandra, you're right. Every week, there's some crazy things going on, and I don't know where else you're going to hear about it other than here. In addition to subscribing, we ask that you share episodes and rate us. If you want to get a hold of us, mail@politicsguys.com is our address, or facebook.com/politicsguyspage / where we have some phenomenal conversations, or as always on Twitter at Politics Guys. The executive producers are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. This episode was produced by Trey Orndorff. We'll have a new show for you on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us then.